Welcome to the Logan Bartlett Show. On this episode, what you're going to hear is a conversation I have with co-founder and CEO of Athletic Brewing, Bill Shufeldt. Now, this is a little bit of a different conversation in which the Athletic is not a technology company, but it's a product that I've grown to love. And so I wanted to have Bill on and talk about his unusual journey into being an entrepreneur. Bill worked at Point 72, which is Steve Cohen's hedge fund, before he stopped drinking and realized there weren't great alternatives to non-alcoholic beer in market. We talk about the state of the beer industry, what it was like in the early days and doing things unscalable to get Athletic's business off the ground, as well as the breakthrough moments that he's seen over the course of the last couple of years, and what the future of Athletic has in store from here. A really fun conversation, a product that I've grown to love, and an entrepreneur I was very impressed with. You'll hear that conversation with Bill here now.
Well, Bill, thanks for doing this.
For sure.
Thanks for having me. Should we do the ceremonial crack here?
Yeah. Cheers.
So Walker Hayes, who I've learned is a country... Cheers. A country music star. I'm sure some people will be amazed that someone that was born in Tennessee... doesn't know who Walker Hayes is, but this is a delicious beer. I was having one earlier when you came in. It's great.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it's a really fun, authentic story. Yeah, so Walker Hayes is an ascending Nashville-based country music star. His most famous song is Fancy Like, which we named the beer after. But like a lot of our celebrity and athlete partnerships, it's like very authentic. Walker discovered our beer himself. He was drinking our beer and posting about it on social media. And so like we engaged with that. Mm-hmm. And he's just like a high performing, very interesting person with great values that we attached to as a brand. And then once we had him up to Connecticut, like his enthusiasm was just there. And he's like the nicest guy in the world too.
How do you go about most of the stuff that I wake up every day thinking about is like either the venture industry or, I don't know, B2B software or consumer internet in some way. And so the concept of brand is like a little like ethereal in how you think about it, or like nebulous to me of what the inputs into that are. So someone like Walker Hayes or JJ Watt or Carly Kloss or whoever it is, right, expresses interest on social or says authentically they're fans of it. How do you actually go about vetting if this person's values is consistent with what you want to represent as a company?
Yeah, there's two parts of these brand conversations too. And each of those people has built a brand up themselves for a long time. And, you know, they are their brand in many ways, and that's what they're compensated and endorsed upon. And so in many ways, they are looking for brands that reciprocate what they want to stand for in the world too. And I know particularly in like Walker and JJ's cases, like that was really important to them, that they loved every piece of Athletic that they came in contact with. And I've always thought of brand as kind of two things. It's like an onion. Like I want a customer to interact with a first superficial vision of Athletic Brewing, like nice packaging, nice logos or something that gets them in. But then over like a 5-year journey, I want them to fall in love with the brand over and over again. And still, like when there are 100 beers in Athletic Brewing, find something out about us that they had no idea that they absolutely love. And like just constantly giving them reasons to talk to their friends about or their family about and like spread that word of mouth. And so we've been really conscious to layer in that brand texture over and over again. And, you know, this brand is my life. So I want it to be deep and meaningful also. Like I don't want it to be some shell contract brewed, contract manufactured company that is like, doesn't really stand for anything, doesn't have any depth. I want quality product that's making a real impact in the world, huge charitable component, giving people great jobs, like big American producer. So there's a lot of depth there that I want our company to represent and be super exciting for our fans too. And that's on the brand side. But like, I think there's like the famous sayings like your brand has to be a movement. And I think that to like retain inertia past the, you know, there's the always the early wave of discoverers who will try anything and anything can look like a success for a year or two. But like to really sustain a big trend over a long time, a real brand has to have a real movement and a real reason for being. So that's something we've also latched ourselves onto and tried to create.
Is there a quantifiable way? This is probably a stupid question to anyone in CPG, but like the quantifiable way you actually assess if the values or how the person is perceived on their socials or what they represent, that you can kind of try to look at the concentric circle overlap of brands? Or is it a little bit more, you know it when you see it type feeling out, or some of both?
You know, I'm a big believer in kind of things that scale and doing things maybe a little slower, but like making less mistakes because of that potentially, or having more depth and meaning when it does get there. So I would say in terms of like some of these key relationships on the brand side, we said Walker Hayes, JJ Watt, David Chang was really similar.
Yeah, sure.
Like all these people we went to, or they came to us either way, and met them in person, spent real time together, and like kind of tried to get a feel for their enthusiasm. Like I'm sure David Chang wouldn't mind me saying this, but he had heard about us through a mutual connection and asked if he could meet, and I immediately went to see him, and we got around a conference table, and it was so clear. He just like totally understood the occasion, the brand, the impact. And he was like, he wanted to taste it. And like me and John were there, who's our co-founder and brewmaster. And the second he tasted the beer, he was like, yes. And like, just like sort of riffing on it with John. And it was a really cool moment to see. And you could tell that natural electricity. And, similar thing with JJ Watt. I'm sure he also wouldn't mind me saying it, but like JJ Watt was a really early discoverer of Athletic and investor, and just such a high performance person that I think he really intuitively understood what we're about. And he was like, but I'm definitely not ready to be the face of non-alcoholic beer. And you know, like he's a Wisconsin guy, sure, big football player, big image. And I was like, can I fly to you? And if you have 15 minutes for me, I'll stand at the end of your driveway with a cooler. And he invited me into his home, and we spent a couple hours together, and he's like the nicest guy, best listener in the world. And was asking all these detailed questions about our brand and what we stand for, and like our Two for the Trails program on charitable. He was like, he runs a big charitable foundation himself. And he was asking questions about that to make sure it was legit. And like, so he was really vetting our brand, but like I could tell in those interactions with them in minutes that they were just like so authentic and into it, where we've had interactions that are totally the opposite,
yeah,
too,
sure,
where we respectfully go the opposite direction and stuff. So
that's interesting. So the stuff that you, and as I mentioned, like I uniquely, enjoy the product, and, I almost always have a case in my fridge.
Oh,
and I think I fall
you.
Into the 80% or 70% or whatever the stat is of people in your customer base or demo that drink alcohol as well and use it as a supplement or augmentation at different times. But I'm curious, when you look back, 2016, 17, when was the start?
Idea was 2014. I quit my job January 1, 2017, launch May 2018.
Yeah. What stuff at a market level that was outside of your control you uniquely got right in the timing? And then what are the things maybe on the brand side that you guys maybe were able to put your finger on the scale and influence in your direction?
Yeah, I think it was, you know, similar to you describing your experience, I was somewhat of a corporate athlete. You know, it's, you know, I'm not on any field of any sort, but like in a high stress hedge fund world where you're graded on your intellect every single day, and then your compensation and advancement reflects that at the end of every year, like there is an incentive to show up and perform at my best every day.
And to be clear for people that don't know, you were at Point 72, which was Steve Cohen's hedge fund. Steve Cohen now owns the Mets, but I think it's rumored Billions was based on the culture of Point 72, and there's some books about SAC and stuff. So definitely a high performance competitive environment, as one of our mutual friends who used to work there has attested to me as well.
Yeah, and credit to everyone in that room. Everyone in that room is showing up and performing every day, and it is the most intellectually challenging environment. Like when words come out of your mouth or you are pitching something, it's got to be thought through, and there are contrarian thinkers challenging every angle of what you're saying.
And the scoreboard's fast, and the scoreboard just is very democratizing or fair. It's like, here's what it was. There's no, it's not venture where you can be like, oh, well, you know, right space, but wrong idea or something. And it's like, oh, that's fooled by randomness. It's like, no, there's a scoreboard and you're going to be kept to it.
And ruthless risk management. If you don't know what you're talking about, like like ideas get reduced. And I credit to Steve. He is in the seat every single day, locked in, knows what he's talking about, and like brings real energy. And it's very fair and meritocratic. So yeah. That was kind of like the background I brought to it, and really wanted to show up and perform my best every day. And I think that's why like a lot of high performing corporate people have like so intuitively gotten our product, is you have to be out 2, 3, 4 nights a week, or doing the extracurriculars your job requires, and like networking and idea dinners and things like that. But I was also, I wanted to be up early working out. I wanted to be at my best at 6:30 when I got to the seat. And, you know, it took me a very long time to realize, but that alcohol was not an element adding to any part of my life in that. But I wanted to be in all those social situations and everything. And so it was a very natural, like, once the light bulb went on with the help of my wife, it was a very obvious idea to me.
The light bulb went on for the company itself.
Yeah, for Athletic Brewing.
Yeah, for when that happened. And the stuff that, as you look on like the trends, because clearly you've established the movement in some ways and built a pretty religious following of your brand. But as I reflect on, like, health trends have been moving in a good direction for a long time. There's probably some element of like the increased wearables. I've two on my hands right now.
Yeah,
and becoming self. I mean, listen, these things are such snitches. If you have like a drink the night before, it's like they know and they yell at you, and my bed yells at me. I get yelled at every direction. So I have to assume that was like one of the things as well.
Yeah. The nice thing is, like, when I showed up at my physical this fall, like an annual physical, I was showing up with not only data from my watch and wearables, but like my Prenuvo scan. And like, I was like, this is all the factual information about what's going on in my body. And like, that just didn't exist 15 years ago. Like, if we wanted answers on diet, I don't know where you would go in 2005.
Yeah.
Like, try to track down and like get old newspapers or something. But it's something I recognized in my own life. And, you know, I was just living a high performance life in many areas. And like, whether that was work, fitness, I was about to get married. I knew I wanted to be like a good parent down the road. And so I was like, just like very future looking. And I was like, oh, easy. Like, this element is not consistent with all the other areas of my life. But then I was kind of, you know, I love food. I'm out and about in one of the biggest cities in the world all the time. I lived in New York for 10 years. I was like, wow, there isn't anything for people who aren't drinking. And then I'd look and I was like, wow, 50% of adults have 0.1 drinks or less per week. Like, that is a huge economic opportunity being missed here. But it was, the trend was just so obvious to me. I didn't have to do a lot of research. I just assumed my experience is probably a very common modern adult experience. And this is a huge hole out there. But like, the whole other part of that too was, you know, identifying a good economic opportunity with a, 10% probability of good economic success.
I'm sure you're doing all this math. What's the arbitrage? Like, you're looking at the data in Europe versus the US and being like, there's clearly some delta.
Yeah, and that's
here.
Why it took, so me and my wife got so excited about the research and had so much fun researching it. And I ran with it for 2 years, but still at the same time, I'm doing that calculus. I'm like, yeah, I will probably never quit my job and do this full time. I actually told a colleague 2 weeks before I resigned that there's a 10% chance I ever do anything with it. And when I resigned, he was like,
yeah.
What happened there was, so 2 years into business planning, my wife read all my materials. She had gotten her MBA, and she had worked a little in VC and gotten her MBA. And so she was in a very receptive place to be hearing an idea. So she really encouraged me in getting going on research and identified, like, it was her enthusiasm in the idea that really helped me get excited about it. It's one of those things where you can't often see things in yourself, but other people watching you taking themselves out of your experience can tell in a second that like, that's the right thing. So it was very much the right thing for my health, my productivity. And she'd seen this entire transformation in my life. Plus there were just all these stats in the world starting to emerge about like the health impact of alcohol on society. And like, I have no interest in ever taking away alcohol. Like, the world's a stressful place and people can choose whatever they want, but I would love people to have great options and for moderation to be destigmatized and cool. And so I was like talking about all these things. My wife saw this huge health impact in me and she sat me down for dinner on like probably December, like 28th, 2016, and basically said, I want you to walk in and quit your job on the second day of the year. And she was like, the impact you could have on this, I don't know if you realize it, but like the impact you've had on yourself, you could take to tens of millions of people. And that's more fulfillment than you'll ever get in your current job. And I think you should take a chance on it. And she's like, by the way, I read all your business materials while you're away and they're amazing. And you have to do this. She's like, I don't want to know you in 20 years if we're still talking about this.
It's not a typical intervention, I would say, that it gets staged on people, I think. I think that's probably a little unique.
And in hindsight, that gets more and more dramatic because it's like, and oh, by the way, this thing you're enormously passionate about, you have great household support for the like budgeting sacrifices and lifestyle sacrifices you'll have to make that a reality.
Which you need, like the stressors of being a founder in general, right? Mm-hmm. Let alone, I'm curious on hedge funds are very lucratively good financial businesses, as I think Steve Cohen's art collection or baseball team would attest. Beer, CPG, all brands, all this stuff. I mean, it's a big, the number of companies that reach your level of success in the way you've gone about it is very small. And it feels like you guys have reached, especially in a new and emerging category and all of that. Was it the mission of it that drew you in and you're like, listen, just based on an impact that I can have on the world versus executing trades 100 at a time over the course of a day. Was that the real appeal? Because I assume starting a hedge fund probably could have been an equally, financially successful endeavor and probably on a risk weighted thing, a much better one to pursue.
Yeah. The seat that I was in was a great 25 year career for the rest of my life. And that very hard to leave. And I found it intellectually challenging and rewarding. And, what has like really lit the fire for how hard the entrepreneurial journey is that impact. Like, it hasn't been the prospect of like a big future payout.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
There is a major desire of mine to, protect shareholder capital and provide great jobs to our teammates. So yeah, like those are major economic drivers for me, but the real one that like lights the fire whenever I'm doing anything totally insane is the impact I could have on the world. And for years on like Saturday and Sunday mornings when the alarm would go off at 3 a.m. and I'd like be going to some event to sample and set up a tent and get made fun of for 6 hours straight. Like that was definitely the impact. And as you know, like every step of building a business is laborious and way more difficult than you would ever think. There's so much more permitting and like accounting and like you wonder how does everyone ever do this? And so that's the kind of thing that got me through for sure.
So to that end on doing things that are scalable going out and trying to change the one, get distribution, but two, destigmatize what is non-alcoholic beer. I think it was the people that drank O'Doul's when I was growing up, like my friend's parents that would have an O'Doul's. It was always with a little smirk that we would be like, oh yeah, they're drinking O'Doul's, not drinking beer. And you mentioned getting made fun of. So there clearly was this like very big stigma behind it. How did you go from a brand standpoint? And we talked about some of the influencers that you involved, but like, how do you think about destigmatizing something like that and making it the perception actually shift? Because I think this is a US-centric perception, right? Europe, I don't think, has the not cool element to the same extent that US did.
Yeah, and I think going back, it is that non-alcoholic beer was born out of prohibition. And so it was immediately deemed as this lesser than item. Everyone wanted the thing they used to have. They're stuck with this. And then basically that thing wasn't innovated on for like 80 years.
So actually prohibition happened in what, 1920s or 1930s, I guess?
Yeah, I think it was throughout the 1920s. And then the Volstead Act was like 1934 or something.
It was, hey, we'll give you non-alcoholic beer in exchange. We're going to take all the stuff with alcohol in it away. And so there was already this negative connotation associated with it because something was taken away from people. And then that was sort of when innovation stopped around it.
Yeah, it was this lesser than product. People had to buy it by default if they wanted beer. And then immediately when alcohol was legalized, people went back to alcoholic beer for the most part. And this kind of just existed with like blips of branding here and there and different launches, but really base macro lagers for a long time. And it was just a really ripe area for innovation to come in, for sure.
From a psychological branding standpoint, I assume the big Miller Coors and Anheuser-Busch and all that have done a purposeful job in some ways of tying masculinity and, you know, the alpha male and sports and all that stuff to the beer industry. As you go in and try to shift that perception and say, no, it's not non-alcohol. It's not the alcohol. We can keep beer. Let's agree it's beer that maybe has some elements of that. Like, how do you go about actually doing it?
Yeah. So on their part, there is a bit of an innovator's dilemma there where like they can't talk too positively about this segment because like 98% of their business is this other segment. So there's a conflict there, which is easier for Athletic. In how I went about and changed the stigma, I kind of knew that if we had ads out there that were just like non-alcoholic beer, people would see that word and immediately shut it off. Yeah. And be like, not for me. That's for my uncle in recovery or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
And, really, our thought was get out there and talk to people face to face and sample. And like people interacting with me and our teammates at sampling booths, and you know, they'd be like, oh, shoot, it's not alcoholic. Never mind. Then I'd be like, try it. Like, if you can make fun of me all you want, if you try it. And like that first taste impression for so many people, and like the light bulb goes on, they're like, oh, you know what? That is delicious beer. I still have to drive home. You know, it's refreshing. And you see them just like going through, checking it in their head. And they're like, you know, I could drink this every night of the week with dinner, right? And like, they like start telling you the occasions where they may drink it. And they interact with me, say I'm a normal person, that I love this, I'm so passionate about it. They find out a little more about the brand. And like, yeah, that's a high intensity, resource intense interaction. Like the, I don't know what the customer acquisition cost of spending 10 minutes talking to someone at a booth that I've driven 6 hours to be at is, but
probably high.
It's not great, but like, I can't tell you how many events I've done and I've gone back to like 3 years later, or like a trail half marathon that I haven't been at since 2018. People have been like, I met you in 2018 and my fridge has been full of your beer ever since. Or like, and in my head, I'm like, that's easily 1,000 LTV customer.
Sure.
And, so I think, like you said, scalable before, and I'm a big fan of these like unscalable activities. If we do enough of them over and over again, like those scalable activities, all of a sudden you turn around and you're like, oh, wow, we activated 3,500 events this
totally,
year.
Totally. I remember, I mean, just to give the authentic of my brand affinity, I realized I probably have had 200 of your beers, and I saw you're going to be at a conference. This is 2 years ago, 3 years ago, and I shot you a note. I couldn't make it or something. I was like, I just want to say thanks. I really like your product, and I don't think I've ever done that to any CEO since or before. And it was just like, yeah, I appreciate that. On the unscalable side of things, there was this vintage of businesses that got going. Mostly on the back of, I think, Facebook and some of the social media companies that have disrupted or tried to go after different industries. Warby Parker going after Luxottica and eyewear, and you know, there's a bunch of others that Dollar Shave Club and razors, and we can come up with a list of ones that grew really quickly and went through all those acquisition channels. I heard that you were adverse to that approach in some ways, and maybe it's a vintage of elements of the you know, acquisition costs of Facebook and ATT and all that stuff that's happened now. And so maybe it's what is it? The motherhood of invention is constrained, or whatever the right phrase is on that. But how did you think about like going really fast versus being more methodical in your growth and your approach?
Well, I can't claim to have sat out all the fun times.
Yeah. Okay.
But it's, so as you said, there was like some incredible entrepreneurs who built awesome businesses in the 2010s and like, all sorts of different levels of success, monetization, true brand building and everything. And some of them were like first to market on all sorts of interesting acquisition channels, like Warby Parker, such a famous example. But like Zappos has so many other ones. And like, there's so many examples of people who like identified unique acquisition channels and just ran with it. Like I think Bombas did an unbelievable job with like audio ads particularly and just like found what worked and drilled into it. And it actually was like the digital ads particularly were actually an incredibly successful scalable channel for us originally because we were a first digitally native beer brand essentially because we do have great partners in the three-tier traditional beer world, but we have omni-channel flexibility with being a non-alcoholic brand. So we launched nationally online and brick by brick spreading out across the nation that way. But where most alcoholic breweries before us, like if they had absolute lightning in a bottle and you were say like a Massachusetts-based brewery, you might have people out the door at your brewery for like 2 hours in a line on a Saturday, but you couldn't sell beer to people in California unless you opened up distributors all over the country. Athletic, when I was launching and raising money at the first, I was like, and we're going to do e-commerce and like, we'll see how it catches. I'll pack the boxes and ship them originally. And, you know, I was doing the marketing, the digital, and just boosting posts basically to target audiences, like pretty simple stuff. But in 2018, 2019, 2020, that was like a real golden age of being able to scale with those programs. And so we would do beer releases where non-alcoholic beer had been nothing but lagers before we launched, basically. And here we are launching 25 to 50 very cool IPAs, sours, everything, pretty much a beer release every week. And we were basically selling out in like 30 seconds on the extremely limited release beers across the whole country. And so we had huge advantages on that front. But I did also come from the financial world. And like, as we started to go into a rising interest rate environment and, you know, we definitely started to be more careful about our capital. And we were also investing a lot in breweries at the time too. And, you know, it's, I think there's a certain timeline, which, you know, also where investors have a lot of forgiveness for say 3 to 4 years. But like, as you turn the corner in that 3 to 5 year range, they really want to see not only good unit economics, but like actually becoming EBITDA positive, if not profitable. And that's kind of where we like really tested the waters on, is this really effective? And there were obviously changes in that ecosystem. And so, so it was great. The digital ecosystem was great for building a national brand and awareness. And we're very thankful to be able to jump through that window as kind of like a first to market non-alcoholic craft brewery introducing all this variety. And we opened up 240 distributors across the country to scale that brick and mortar ecosystem alongside of it. But in many ways, when we were launching those markets and distribution, we were launching into warm water because we had been there with digital advertising and product releases. So
the awareness was there as well. Yeah.
Which was like a very unique advantage. And now we can layer in more traditional marketing.
In what ways do you fall into the beer market? And versus in what do you fall into the sparkling water market from a regulatory standpoint and like how things can get distributed? It sounds like you could do e-commerce, but there's probably stuff on health benefits or whatever that you can't say like this is better for you than XYZ thing, right? That's probably a little bit of a subjective analysis. Like where do you fall in the sort of regulatory paradox there?
Yeah, so we catch a little of everything. We definitely have advantages in marketing, but in other ways, we like can't use a lot of beer words. We can't use beer, lager, stout, ale, words like that.
Because those are branded to mean
a certain level of alcohol. And so that's confusing
IPA
for customers.
Can, or is that?
We can that. Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. But then, you know, we wish we could make health claims.
Yeah.
Which I won't do right now.
We can anecdotally. I will make a health claim on your behalf that when I have two athletic beers in a given night, I wake up feeling far better than when I have two of any alcoholic drink. My sleep is better. My Oura Ring is more forgiving. My 8 sleep mattress doesn't yell at me. So I can make the health claims on your behalf at a very personal level. That's my experience.
Now I can't reshare the post. But like personal anecdotes and experiences, I think are totally fine.
It's my opinion.
Like, my life is like a walking example of that.
Yeah, totally.
I went from...
But we are... the example of that is we're treading on a... Like that is a line of some of the
yeah, I couldn't say because of athletic beers I can run ultra marathons and sleep nine hours a night through the night and stuff like that.
Yeah, so, it's interesting. Yeah. It's an interesting distinction that exists between all
but
that.
But like the commentary around the industry though is kind of circling back to that other point is so strong though. It's out of really all corners of the country. It's from traditional media and like governmental health agencies all the way to like bleeding edge lifestyle hackers of health information and like people like Andrew Huberman and Peter Attia providing like the most like cutting edge health info out there.
That podcast Huberman did, there's one just on alcohol that I assume, has proliferated circles around the NA world, but I've listened to it 2 or 3 times, right? It's really informative about the derivative considerations and his scientific opinion, about alcohol and the negative effects of it. I assume there's tailwinds or some anecdotal evidence that that's probably been a boon, to the industry as well.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot in there that we anecdotally knew by experience and like, you know, my own experience with alcohol, but like I didn't know the mechanisms and actually what was going on in the body and stuff. So it's really interesting to listen to that. And yeah, that was the number one most forwarded podcast last year on Apple Podcasts.
Is that right? Jeez.
Yeah. Out of everything.
We were actually number 2, 3, 4, but it's nice that we gave Andrew number one. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. He took the top mantle, but you know, whatever. We'll let him have his one. So the big shift though, there were all these like little micro trends. I feel like, and we talked about Huberman or Attia and, you know, wearables and I assume, I don't know, cannabis probably became an alternative for drinking for some people. And we could probably come up with other things, but the destigmatization, and the endorsement on some of the celebrity side and stuff, was there a single moment that you look back on and you're like, okay, that felt like a tipping point, that when we got into Whole Foods or when JJ Watt signed up some moment that really felt like the conversation maybe shifted from getting made fun of at those races to people knowing and gladly accepting it?
You know what? The like anecdotal evidence has always been so strong. Like whenever I can get a beer in someone's hand or, you know, I was our direct customer line into the company for the first 2 years and I was getting all the DMs. And so there was always like being that close to the customer and the brand, I almost immediately knew that my life experience was on track with what was going on in the world. And like, so the signs of progress were always there and it's really hard to identify like any single wins. I don't know if other entrepreneurs are like this, but like me and John are so, we have to be really intentional about being like, hey, celebrate this win. And also like, let's be sure to hit pause and share it with the team. Cause I'm like such a problem hunter where like I'm hungry for constructive feedback and just like, you know, you very often like, don't take the wins and just celebrate on the losses. So I've always been like really into like gratitude at the end of the day. Also is like part of my entrepreneurial journey is like actually pausing as I'm getting to bed and being like, what were 3 really good things that happened today? Mm-hmm. And being like generally thankful for those. Cause like the best thing in the world could happen at 10 AM and I could even like forget to even like mention it when I get home. And I'm just like literally thinking about these like 3 really random annoying things.
Yeah. The it's like the gambling adage or whatever that losses feel 2x mm-hmm. worse than wins feel good or something. I think a lot of entrepreneurs internalize that data point quite a bit.
For sure. And not to circle back on the other question from before, but I think I just started walking down a different path. You know, there were so many incredible businesses born in the 2010s.
Yeah, sure.
And like so many entrepreneurial success stories across really all verticals. And like a lot of them had very little to do with the easy money policy. They're just like frankly incredible businesses. And there's so many long-term businesses that like finally came to fruition from, you know, businesses that have been being built that like really matured in the 2012 to 2018 area.
Who do you hold in that like regard that you sort of think of?
Well, obviously like Facebook is such a success case and it's always been successful, but like they had their own valleys for sure. Just so many businesses out there that, I think just in the past 5 years or maybe like slightly before that, we got so used to businesses being like 3 year success stories and, you know, like get product market fit, scale the hell out of it and it's done fast. And, one big thing in my journey, like it relates to the unscalable behaviors and also the like building a deeper brand and also reflecting on businesses of the last 20 years, is like time is very often a variable that's not that talked about. Yeah. And like everyone talks about like how big a force compounding is, but then doesn't practice it. And like, I'm really here thinking that if we just stay at this for a long time and are really consistent in our brand and, you know, our awareness is still so low that like all the gains are going to come over a 10 plus year timeline probably.
Yeah. And, it's a hard thing for time and compounding to internalize. I'll get the stat wrong, but something like if Warren Buffett died at 72 or something, he would have been worth like $50 million or something like that. It's just like, it was the compounding that happened after for the next 25 years or whatever it is, 22 years that has led to, and I'm wrong on the number. I'm sure maybe it's $1 billion or something, but like whatever the number is, it's like, we wouldn't have, part of it was the longevity at which he kept doing it that has led to such major financial gains for him. And I think that's true of the entrepreneurial journey as well. It's just like, if you keep doing the inputs over and over again, there's a lot of stuff that tends to fall your way.
Yeah. And to tie it into my own industry, some examples of that, like companies that are enormous that people assume have always just been here, but like, you know, Red Bull, Monster, Twisted Tea are all categories that are like, are all companies that are like 25 year success stories, you know, and it's just like they have a 10% CAGR and all of a sudden they're just like a $50 billion
company. Yeah, you sort of forget about the vintage of those companies, I guess. I it's an interesting point. And also, I feel like there's some, and this isn't, I'll pretend like this is an original idea, but it's definitely plagiarized from someone else. But as we've moved from the four main television channels, whatever, when our parents were growing up, to the cable networks, to now the streaming services and the infinite proliferation of different social media and just personalized experiences, you're able to get much more tailored experience. Like you're no longer beholden just to Tide as your only detergent. Like there's actually all this, and then distribution's no longer tied at the choke point of the point of sale necessarily. And so it's allowed, I think, all these different brands to survive, which is why Luxottica no longer just has a monopoly on the eyewear market like they once did. As you look back on the journey, one of the big distribution points was Whole Foods, or one of the big successes. What year was that in your journey? How did that come to be?
Yeah, I mean, nothing about our launch was easy. From finding our co-founder was hundreds of conversations with brewers until I found John, who is absolutely incredible.
Where was John before?
New Mexico.
And so. Doing like a...
He's just at a small brew pub, not even canning beer, but they were racking up awards. And he was just, I was going to conferences and talking to like dozens of people every conference, having hundreds of phone conversations, literally trying to get someone interested in this job. And
so you started a company. I assume you don't exactly, you're not exactly a maker of non-alcoholic beer if you don't have a maker of non-alcoholic beer, right? So at this point, you're a founder just kind of dating, looking for someone that will say that's a good idea.
Yeah, it's basically a founder with a white paper who is really into finance and sales and marketing without a technical
supportive wife and ready to go do this. And you needed, it's funny. Sometimes I'll be like, I'll hear from, you know, buddies that I went to high school with or college. And they're like, I have this great idea. I just need like a tech guy. And I'm like, all right, well, that's not, that's actually a pretty key requisite to having a good idea is having a good tech guy. So, like, I mean, you had a very good insight, but until you had a, someone to go execute it on, you were, yeah, you were sort of looking for that.
For sure. And then it happened to be that John, as a co-founder, had like so many complementary traits to me as a person too. And it's like, that's worked out beautifully.
Did he move?
He did, yeah. And then we started homebrewing in an empty warehouse, two people who didn't know each other at all for like 8 hours a day.
And you had read a bunch of books. Like, I guess the process of brewing and kind of figuring out what was, why does this, besides the pretty packaging and Walker Hayes on it, like, why is this such a better product than the O'Doul's that, you know, whatever, my dad's single friend drank?
Yeah, it was definitely one of our kind of first principles moment was, you know, rather than starting at the end point and being like, okay, this is how people make non-alcoholic beer. We're going to get this equipment and make it and hope the hops survive this incredibly processed system. We decided to back it up and like read textbooks about the background of like, John already knew this because he'd been brewing, but I needed to like start from square one. And think about like, how do you bring along those esters, aromas, products of fermentation that are like so delicate? Like beer is every bit as delicate as like a nice bottle of wine in many ways. And we wanted to like respect those ingredients and treat them well and carry that through to the final product. So coming up with that brewing process in an all natural way was like a big technical challenge and scientific challenge. And we did hundreds of trials to try to get to that. And then the food safety challenges on the back end too, with like without ethanol as a preservative is a big one also. So
can you elaborate on that? That's a fascinating point, but ethanol actually serves as, it has a purpose, other than the alcohol component, right?
For sure. And so, we've invested a lot of money in things like tunnel pasteurizers, which aren't common in the craft beer world, but, I know the word pasteurizer, it doesn't have the best image, but I don't think it's understood. Essentially, what a tunnel pasteurizer is, at least, is when this beer is in its finished container, it goes very slowly along a conveyor and basically gets a shower. So there's no chemicals or processing ever touching the inside of the can. It just gradually warms up the beer to like a temperature that's just high enough to kill any bacteria, yeast, or anything that's going to be a spoilage organism in there. And then it cools it off again. But it's like, it's incredibly gentle to the product and everything. So, but like no one else really in beer besides the mega breweries was doing things like that. And we had to invest in these enormous tunnel pasteurizers to be sure that our product was bulletproof from a food safety perspective. And there are all these technical challenges. Like John and I got food safety degrees and stuff. So a lot went into that. And in the middle of all that, we're just there churning homebrew, like trying thing after thing. John approached we had a target method in mind, but he's like, okay, we're going to start all the way over here and we're going to change each variable by 1 degree or like time or pH any given day. And like that added up. I was like, but if we end up over here, that's going to be like at least 100 trials if that's the method. And he's like, yeah, it's going to take us a long time.
Well,
and so we stood around and did that. And then
how much did this process take money wise of doing like iterating on this? Cause it's not like shipping bits of code, right? It's there's a lot of process that goes into this.
Yeah. Not much. Our rent was like $7,000 a month. And like there wasn't
getting
much
the materials and stuff wasn't super expensive. And,
for sure.
No, so it was just really just your time that was expensive. On a relative basis. Okay. And so you're going through this process and have you raised outside capital
at
this
point? The process of raising from like basically the minute I met John, I started raising and I thought I was going to have 10 conversations in 2 weeks and raise the.
Sure.
I was initially going to raise $1.5 million and then I ended up raising three just to like give a big cushion. I doubled the size of the brewery we were planning to build. And every contract brewer in the country basically had said no to working with us. So we had to pivot to build the brewery ourselves.
And why did they say no? They just didn't believe in the idea or
orthogonal to their business? In fairness to them and their perspective, looking at what I was pitching to them,
they didn't believe in 0.72 as a background.
Great business decision on their part to say no. Yeah, it's sure. Like we didn't have a recipe. We didn't have the process. Yeah. Like we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't have demand once it was already made. So like building a brewery was the right decision, and I just didn't know that.
So the verticalization, what did that allow you to do differently because you actually own the full process?
So it's actually been a huge boon, especially through like the COVID period and stuff, that we own so much of everything we do. And like, you can pretty much hedge out a lot of what we do too, and get pretty good certainty. So it allows us to control quality, like every drop of liquid that comes out of our facilities. Like, we can do everything from ingredient inspection to testing everything that's in tanks multiple times a day, make sure everything's within spec, and if not, it goes down the drain. And then we do 55 more tests on every run before it goes out the door too. And so like, we hold ourselves to a really high standard of quality that we couldn't possibly ask of someone else making our beer. And so there's a lot of advantages there too. And like, during like peak summer season, or if there's fluctuation, or we want to make something different in any given day for any given reason, like, we have pure flexibility in our facilities to do whatever. And then we also fulfill a lot of our orders in-house too. So it's like, there's a lot going on within our spaces that adds to the economics. But yeah, back to your other question. So we were homebrewing the empty warehouse. The beer started to taste good. So John started making it at his house too, where we had like a little bottling setup, where we're hand bottling into plain brown bottles. And I was going around to the state of, just all over the state of Connecticut, because no distributors wanted to work with us until we like, I knew if I proved I had a couple hundred stores that would want to buy the beer immediately on available, a distributor would be like, of course, we'll work with you. So I essentially went around and opened 300 accounts myself, and would go with brown bottles, have people taste it, show them an image of what the cans will probably look like in 3 months. And brick by brick, signed up a number of retail accounts, almost all of which were skeptical. And like, I played all sorts of shenanigans around this. Like, I would find people in the parking lot and be like, I'm having a really tough day, can you do me a solid and come in like 2 minutes behind me? I'll be talking to the person at the cashier, and just be like, and like, so people would pop over my shoulder and be like, did you say non-alcoholic beer? That's an IPA? Get out of here. Or yeah, like, a woman would, like, one time at this store in Westport, I had a woman come in and be like, did you say 50 calories? No way. Where can I buy that? And like, the guy was like, yeah, we'll take it when it's ready. Like,
that's funny.
But like,
talk about unscalable stuff, the word of mouth, the validation in all of that. And so then the people that it resonated with on the investor side, were they people that just believed in you and from the, whatever, the finance world, or were these people that uniquely believed in non-alcoholic beer, or what was the combination of that?
Yeah, some were like friends, family, colleagues, like a good portion of that. And then I did get a surprising amount of no's or non-responses among like people I thought would definitely be in, but like, you know, also like, everyone's got different financial moving parts in their life. And like, I definitely was not begging anyone to lob checks in with low probability of return. And, but was really lucky in that like a lot of no's that I thought were probably yeses, all of a sudden those people would reach back out and be like, you know, I have this other friend that I think would be really into it. And like, there's this amazing network of like 1 degree away connections that I made, and like people I didn't know before, but are now like very good friends or awesome supporters. And I ended up doing about 120 meetings. So we'd homebrew during the day, and then I'd go to meetings at night or travel or wherever. And did 120 meetings. We had 66 investors in our angel round. Wow. Ended up raising about $3 million. And it was, you know, it's been an incredible group. And they came right back on our Series A. And like, that group, like, I wrote monthly investor updates for 4 years, and I do quarterly now as like an accountability exercise. And I knew if all else goes south, I want this to be like a fun, meaningful journey for these people. Sure. And like, writing those investor letters, it was actually like a very meaningful, informative process for me in terms of accountability, progress, and keeping them up to speed. I had this army of ambassadors, and a lot of our best connections as a brand have come through that network of people, of our angel investors too. So
it's fascinating.
Yeah. I got so lucky in that part of the journey. And like, there's so much reflecting on the journey now that I like maybe got right by accident.
Yeah, what was that? Like, what was the, picking the angel investors or sort of lucking into them? What was the, things you got right?
I think so often, both on the founder side and the investor side, there's so little like alignment on like what do we both want here before we like jump into this, you know? And I've seen founders who are incredibly like long-term and want to build a 20-year-old brand who have like people who want to scale now and fast and go. Or on my side, like I knew we had to lay out a very big network of manufacturing, hire salespeople, run deeply unprofitable for a while, and then start to really scale the business and get profitable. And so I, on that long-term time horizon, I got very lucky with the like more private oriented investors, but we did bring in a great consumer private equity firm along that journey in our Series C, which was probably the perfect stage too to have some support in business maturity, structuring board meetings, thinking about the long-term org chart, like, things that you know very well about, like that are great to introduce at a certain stage in business, but there is that earlier stage where the flexibility and speed is so key too.
Was the mission kind of the unifying belief between you and the investors initially, and that that the people that were doing, obviously they wanted a financial return, but that wasn't the sole purpose, similar to you, that like it wasn't only about the financial opportunity that this presented. Was that sort of the overlapping concentric circles between you and the initial investors?
Yeah, I think they had long-term belief in what we were doing and that ultimately it would be that I would deliver on that.
Yeah.
The details of how we get there, the time horizon, things like that were pretty flexible.
Yeah.
And, you know, I definitely don't claim to know that I had all the answers, and I've learned a lot of that in hindsight. And like, that's one of the, like the top things I try to talk about with founders. Like I try to suss out, like, what do you want? Like, what's your goal? How long will that take you to get there? Like that should be informing your investor decision in a big way too. So
that's interesting. So what is, I mean, hard to say what the future holds, but is stuff outside of the beer category interesting to you? Is will it for the foreseeable future sort of stay within the bounds? Anything that as you kind of look forward that piques your interest?
Yeah, that's kind of the challenge, is like everything always piques our interest, and John and I love innovation and we're tinkerers, and like
the constraint is a important consideration.
My ideal breakfast or lunch is finding a restaurant with a drinks menu with like six different functional fermented things on it that I can like surround my plate with. So like the interest is there. But I think the constant challenge is to like remember that we're still relatively early stage, low distribution, low awareness, and stay focused on the true opportunity and just like kind of execute relentlessly on that. And then, you know, there is probably a time in the future to become a better diversified company, or, wait patiently until those true opportunities do emerge.
Yeah, so, present themselves.
Yeah, we definitely have ideas, but like, I think that discipline is, if those ideas are only like 60% as good as our core idea, like it might be worth a beta test and like testing it to like make sure we're right about that. But at the end of the day, dollars and time taken away from the core is dollars and time likely taken away.
I want to talk a little bit about like running the company and the business of beer or alcohol, but I'm curious, experiences that you took from Point72 over, I'm sure there were elements of the day-to-day that didn't port straight over, but probably elements that did. What did you like replicate from that experience in Athletic today?
I'd like to say like a contrarian thinking mindset, you know, like from the moment a discussion emerges about an idea in a place like Point72, like everyone's trying to help you think through the pitfalls of it to like, you know, try to keep things out of everyone's collective portfolios that could be right with gold mines. And so I think that's been part of it, is just, being a critical thinker and like the velocity of that too. I don't know, there's other things that like people in the beer industry might even find offensive, like the velocity of emails. And like, I met John, who was in the beer industry, and I've heard him joke about it since, but like the speed at which I sent him 100 emails after we met was probably like outright terrifying.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure.
And then we hired more people from the financial industry, and like all of a sudden the culture was just like
professional persistence is something that I don't know if it's been totally imparted on all parts of mainstream business in general, at least what you learn in the finance industry. It might not be the most natural thing.
But also, like, in so many industries, people try to, like, put a pin in something and be like, okay, let's circle back on this on next Thursday. I'm like, wait, why are we solving this now? Like, what is stopping us from, like, literally solving this right now or tomorrow? And, like, what does next Thursday have to do with this?
Yeah.
Like, it's like, and so there is, like, a whole different speed in some ways too. But at the same time, you know, it's that consistency too. And finance, I was in the seat every day, locked in, like, very specific routines. And I think for that reason, I have, like, no problem working, like, kind of relentless 10-hour days.
And sure.
I think I have, like, pretty good balance at this point. I have, like, good family time, but, like, a very clear 10 hours where I'm, like, getting stuff done every day.
Yeah.
And I kind of think of it as, like, you know, just very consistently going, like, 65 miles an hour down the highway. Like, every single day I'm at it every year. And, like, so many people on our team is that way too, that we're just, like, really consistent making progress.
I've heard you be fairly magnanimous in your praise for what ostensibly could be considered, like, competitors in the industry or people that kind of have similar-ish missions or maybe they're copying you guys, however, whatever the appropriate way of framing it is. But you don't seem very zero sum from a competitive standpoint in the industry. I guess first, is that a fair characterization? And second, if so, why is that the case?
Multiple faces of that. I think I think anywhere where you're doing good work and adding value is ultimately positive sum. And I think they're also, even in big trends, does tend to be power law type return. So I think I have an element of confidence in our execution and our staying power in the industry. But also with, like, the size of the trend we think we're on, plus the populations we want to bring into the category, a really healthy range of well-supported brands is positive for that ecosystem. And so, you know, Heineken launched their 00 in the US about 6 months after we launched as a brand. And I was really excited for that. Like, a lot of maybe our investors or, like, other people were asking me, like, questions about being worried. And it's like, you know, this is one of the most thoughtful, well-branded companies in the world. And they're probably going to meaningfully enter the space and do a good job on marketing. And they've done just that. And then it's great to see, like, a non-alcoholic Guinness in the space, a non-alcoholic Corona. So, like, those are fun beers with name recognition that, like, help people easily jump into the category. But if people like their experience in the category and realize, like, they don't miss the alcohol that much, like, my hope is eventually they get to Athletic and are like, wow, that is a really good beer too.
Yeah.
And kind of where I do have problems is where, like, you know, there are chancers and opportunists in any trend too.
Sure.
And so people who, like, really underinvest and aren't necessarily telling an authentic quality proposition, aren't making the product themselves. And, you know, but, like, cut and paste the whole website. You know, I've had people who we've had essentially the same words on our cans for 6 years now. And, like, the whole paragraph has ended up on multiple websites.
Really?
Or, like, our whole about page with basically just the names changed. You know, there was also someone whose, like, little brother did a business school project on Athletic and, like, didn't tell me that, like, their brother was launching it. And so things are dilutive if you are, like, stealing all the words and all the ideas but not delivering on those things. That is dilutive.
Sure.
To the consumer too.
Sure.
So that kind of thing bothers me, but I love it when people are making a real honest go and investment in the category. So
I've heard you talk about leading with a why within your team and explaining to your company, like, the why behind a lot of things rather than more unilaterally making the decision or ruling with an iron fist on when things get decided. Why do you think that's an important principle for you guys as a company?
Well, I think it helps layer depth into a decision, gives people purpose when they're doing something and may not see the reason to it. They're like, oh, this is why we need to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that's helpful in adding just, like, day-to-day fulfillment rather than, like, rote tasks, like people basically going down someone's checklist and they don't know the meaning for it.
Yep.
But also I'm like the expert of absolutely nothing. I have a lot of inherent brand intuition and customer intuition because I've dealt with tens of thousands of our customers individually and have been along for the ride on a lot of brand mistakes and stuff. So maybe we have already made certain mistakes already and stuff. So, but I also share, I'm very transparent with our team and share more info on why and stuff like that. So that our teammates who are very likely better at what we're talking about than I am can give that feedback in real time and disagree. And we like to have a very flat hierarchy where dialogue is appreciated, collaboration is encouraged and stuff. So
you're not, particularly disparaging or antagonistic to the alcohol industry. And I guess that's probably a smart tactic given a lot of your customer base also drinks alcohol. But there are, we talked a little bit about some of the health considerations around it. One of the questions I had, and I alluded to this earlier, but why was non-alcoholic such a big thing in Europe? I think it's, is it 10% of the overall industry over there?
Depends on the country. It's, I think on average throughout Europe, it's like 5.6% of the beer market.
Which is in the US today is what?
Like 1.3%, something like that.
1.3. Okay. Yeah, it was when you started, maybe it was.
It was like 0.3 when we started. In a lot of channels in the US, it's getting up to 5 to 10%. It's just like there are very large channels where it's still zero,
sure.
Basically. Like convenience and stuff.
Is the cultural reason though, tying back to that prohibition point, or why did it, like, what did Europe do right that's different than the US?
I think so. Europe has a bit more of a lager culture. So like non-alcoholic lagers being very present and available. They had very well-respected breweries investing in it early on. So that's part of it. But I think prohibition is one of the key things. Spain is one of the biggest cultures. I think it's somewhere 12 to 15% of all beer in Spain is non-alcoholic beer consumed. Part of that is that it's very affordable. And I think I'm speaking with big generalizations, but the Spanish culture is prone to like very long sessions and like 10 p.m. dinners and like shutting it down at 2 or 3 in the morning. And even as like whole families. And so I think like a pace of moderation so you can like hang out during that whole thing is something. I think business lunches in Europe and the UK are much more likely to potentially feature alcohol. A lot of these countries had low alcohol popular styles to begin with, whether that on the continent that's like farmhouse beers, saisons, things like that, or in the UK like bitters and mild ales and like mid-strength beers, brown ales, like just so many really good 2 to 4% offerings, where the US there's always been this, like, of course there are like the macro light beers that are like 4.2%, but like
sure.
So much US beer is high octane too.
It's crazy.
So, yeah.
People slugging like 10-12% beers.
But like a big part of the reason why I'm not disparaging to the alcohol industry is like the world is stressful. And while alcohol, there's a lot of health evidence out there, there's also, the world's stressful and people need to like take a break from that in certain ways. Like it can be that, it can be socializing, it can be exercise, it can be meditation or whatever is people's thing. Also, a lot of great introductions in the world have happened that may not have happened. Like how many couples have gotten together and would have been scared to talk to each other if not for alcohol, you know? So it's hard to...
I met my wife at 1:30 at a bar. So who knows if not. But some of the stats on like the negative stuff, even outside of health, I didn't realize how big. So 15 million plus or minus Americans.
It's like 14.8.
14.8. And that's like disclosed, let alone the whatever multiplier that's undisclosed, suffer from alcoholism or some form of alcohol abuse. Is that right?
That's the numbers I've read. 14.8 million documented cases of alcohol use disorder in the country. You know, it's, I've read recently that 5% of all cancers are suspected to be attributed to alcohol. There was an article on CNN a few weeks ago. Like all substances in general, 70% of incarcerated people were under the influence of substances, 40% of those being alcohol. So I don't know what year these stats are, but like, there is a lot of potential good to be done in the world by moderate options. But the great thing is, it's not like we're going at the alcohol industry in any way. Like, we are producing growth in the industry. This is volume. It's occasions. You know, people are drinking very little beer Sunday through Thursday, for the most part. This is a chance to sell people beer and give them a lot of enjoyment in those occasions. And it's something like 60% adults have 0.1 drinks or less per week. So, like, the BevAlc world is also largely missing that cohort. Like, that is a lot of people to include in bars and restaurants and menus and bring good times to. I reflect on my generation. I used to live on the second floor above a great New York City bar. And
what bar was it?
Village Tavern in the West Village. And like, me and my friends were probably in there 3 or 4 nights a week. And it was like very normal to just like stop in there and see if people were there. And like, I reflect on the experience of like what I hear from people who are 15, 20 years younger than me. Like, the corner independent bar seems to be like slipping away. And like, I think by making exciting non-alcoholic options, great cocktails, great non-alcoholic beer, beer on draft, there's a great way to get people back in, watching sports, socializing. Like, these are important community places. Like,
have you been to the Village Tavern recently?
I walked by it with my wife and son, probably like a month ago.
They redid it inside. It looks like a real establishment, not what we would have remembered, whatever, 10, 15 years ago. It's like actually, you know, they redid the TVs, and it's not as the nostalgia I had for the place that it once was is long gone, probably for the best, walk inside. So it looks a lot better than it did a decade ago plus.
Well, a little bit of my heart's in that old renovation.
Yes, for sure. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. One of the things I heard you say, the term sober is, I don't know, do you think it has a negative connotation associated with it, or is it just sort of an outdated, like, overly specific term?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where like everyone is sober most of the time.
Yeah,
like, it's like, why isn't there a word for people who don't drink energy drinks or something? Like, alcohol is just a functional drink,
yeah,
in many ways. And like, why does there have to be a word for when you're not consuming
coffee? We don't have a, you know, any term associated with that.
And
I call them psychos that don't drink coffee, but you know, I mean, whatever, there's no term that goes along with it.
And so like I know there's words like flexitarian and other diets and stuff, like whether it's flex sober or just like, I drink alcohol occasionally and don't other times, like it should be a much more flexible mindset these days, you know?
Yeah.
And, I think keeping words like that around, and like, it's just so outgrown in modern society that it's like, why do people keep like using this outdated concept? But like, when concepts like that are held on to, I think it really holds back the opportunity for like everything that's out there.
Has there ever been a point that you've thought about like moderately like a glass of wine or anything? Because it's been what, 12 plus years since you've...
It's been probably about like 10 and a half years for me. And I've honestly lost track, but it's, so I guess that answers the question, like, but it's, you know, I love good food, good drink. And honestly, like, the itch is totally scratched by, you know, I drink multiple of our beers all the time. There's now a number of good non-alcoholic wines.
There are good non-alcoholic wines. I've never,
tried some recently. I really like Oddbird, Leeds. There's a few of them, but getting better and better every year. And,
Link these in show notes. We'll go investigate. I'll do a taste test sample on them.
Yeah, I could share some. And then, you know, like Ritual and other non-alcoholic spirits are like making good spirits, and there's great bitters companies too. And so like, you can make pretty sophisticated off the shelf home cocktails and stuff too. And I honestly just never honestly find myself tempted at all, but I did make I made a cold turkey decision, because if I didn't have a plan, I just figured I'd never make the decision.
Sure.
And it was enough of a friction and a drag on my productivity and where I wanted to be as an adult that I just knew I like that it was a worthwhile decision to go that cold turkey. And I also didn't want to keep the risk around that, like, you know, I just never wanted to be the adult who has children who was like blowing himself up on Friday.
Yeah.
Like, I wanted to like make sure that risk was off the table also. And, you know, it, one thing I always struggled with was, you know, I was like, oh, well, I'll go out and only have one beer tonight. And like, you get home at 2 a.m. and you've had 8 beers and you're like, well, that didn't work. And I'm like, well, what went wrong there? And it's like, because I had that one beer in like 20 minutes. And then like, what is the plan after that? There are no other options. There's nothing. And so like,
oh, I by the way, I still will have 8 beers. I just try to work in your product, you know, into 5 of them or something. Like I'll still do the same thing. And it's, I don't know what it is. It's the habitual of like the taste, or I'm curious, the psychological element of actually like drinking a beer. I was at a family occasion, I guess, a couple of weeks ago, and it was a Friday night, and I think I put down 3 Athletics, just like sitting there at the dinner table. No other beer. I was just like slugging Athletics, and I'm not really sure what that sensation is. It's probably some like psychological trained thing that I don't know.
Yeah, and if Athletic existed and good non-alcoholic cocktail menus existed at that time, like maybe I wouldn't have had to make that choice and give up drinking entirely. Because like there would have been an easy bridge from that plan. I'd be like, oh, I'm going to have one beer and then 5 Athletics tonight.
Yeah.
You know, and...
What is the sensation of drinking, though? I'm sure you've studied it a little bit at a psychological level, like the perception of, I mean, some of it's taste, some of it's the environment you're in from a, you know, like after work or the sensations around it, right? I'm a big college football fan, and I can't even imagine, I've actually done it with Athletic now, but like going to a college football game without having a beer, it's just like, there's all these little occasions that are sort of built into life, I feel like.
Yeah, so it's exactly that. And I kind of like 3 takeaways I've realized is, A, I just loved being in those moments, and it didn't take me long at all to realize that I just loved being in those moments, and it wasn't about the alcohol.
Yeah.
Because I was still having fun with all my friends with nothing in my hand. And very often, like, my favorite moments weren't the after 2-3 hours when the alcohol hits. It was when you get to a bar and you have that first drink, and I see my brother who I haven't seen in a month, and like, we're just catching up, and like those were all my favorite moments. And like, I also love I realized I liked buying drinks and doing stuff like that more than I ever liked drinking it myself.
And
to answer your more sensory question on the experience, like, you know, we've all been drinking alcohol as humans for like 5,000 years. And there's something about that ritual when you crack a beer and you smell the malt and the hops and that ritual that is like so much more ingrown and born of evolution than anything you've experienced in your own life. And so I think there is an enormous wave of a placebo effect
that
maybe isn't related to the alcohol at all. But like, you know, when I sit down and watch a sporting event, or even in the afternoon, like very often I'll have an IPA at 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and it's got a very calming effect. And
yeah, for sure. Yeah. It's probably, I don't know, nature versus nurture and all that, but probably some combination of both. Certainly growing up doing it, it's
for sure. You know, I did have, you know, my 10,000 hours of mastery of drinking beer and relaxing.
That's right. We perfected that.
Maybe it's like a little less evolution, my own historical perspective as well. So
that's right. Yeah. If you go back and tell yourself in 2014 or 2016, something about the entrepreneurial journey, is there something that stands out that you wish you had known when you were getting going?
I'm sure there are a million people that would definitely point out like incredibly stupid things I've done along the way. But like, I think there's definitely an advantage to like experiencing everything and learning it. So I wouldn't necessarily trade any step of the experience for anything.
Hmm.
So,
yeah.
You know, we have a lot of investors and all great people. And so... Yeah, tough to pinpoint any single one thing.
Yeah. I mean, I guess the thing that sort of resonates or stands out the most is like, and it's almost the founding tenet of the business is the mission orientation of it, or like the true belief in what you're doing beyond the financial gain, the power, running a big company, all of that. And so it's not often are founders so uniquely passionate about the problem that they're solving. So I think that probably helps you every late night when you're working on something, or every early morning.
Yeah, no, I say this to my co-founder a lot, but if there was a button so often at, you know, I try to break for, I've structured my day nicely where I have like, I try to do some family in the morning, then have a great work day, family for two or three hours in the evening, and then like another mini work day where I like mostly do projects at night, or the email flywheel. But there are so many times at 10 or 11 at night, I would press a button if it were there to give me an extra 12 hours of work,
yeah,
which is like something I never would have done in the past.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
I'm very thankful for that, for sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much. Yeah, it was really fun.
Thank you for joining this conversation with Athletic co-founder and CEO Bill Shufeldt. If you enjoyed this discussion, please share with anyone else that you think might find it also interesting. Also, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you listen to this conversation on. We'll see you here next week with another great guest on the Logan Bartlett Show. Have a good weekend, everyone.